Welcome back to the Voicemails from History podcast. I'm your host, Mr. Amin, and in this episode, we're going to look to the colourful regions of Central Asia and Eastern Europe, an area vastly underappreciated and subdued among Western perceptions. For thousands of years, this area was the centre of the globe's trading links, of warring empires, of migration, and a witness to the complex nature of individual and group identity formation. So today's focus is going to be on a group of people called the Crimean Tatars. I came across this topic in my final year of university while studying a module on Stalinism, where we studied the Soviet Union from a domestic angle. I think one thing that people tend to overlook is how vast the Soviet sphere of control was over the different ethnicities and nations inside the border. I'm going to give an overview of the Crimea and the Crimean Tatars themselves before focusing on their experience with the Soviet Union in the 20th century. I'll explain the ever-shifting Russian and then Soviet policy towards them. For me, their story brings up really interesting questions on the idea of indigenous peoples, of generational trauma, on nationality policy, and on the politics of sentiment and emotion. Okay, let's begin. So the Crimea has had a few moments in the limelight in the recent years due to Russia's interests. Following a so-called referendum in 2014, Russia went ahead and in what became an international crisis, annexed the country of Ukraine, which included the Crimean Peninsula. Now, the geography of Crimea is really important to visualise. So Crimea is coastal, its southern border is the Black Sea, and it's surrounded by countries from both Asia and Europe. So to its north, it's the Crimea and Ukraine, to the south, Turkey, east is Georgia, and to its west, there's the countries of Bulgaria and Romania. So what I need to do now is explain the history behind the territory, Crimea, and the people, the Tatars. Now the name Tatar has quite a complex history, so we'll start with territory first. Historically, this region has played a really important role due to acting as a sort of gateway between the two continents of Europe and Asia. So let's go chronologically. So starting in the 5th century, Crimea's coast experienced a flourish of Greek city-states from the ancient Greek Empire. It then became an outpost of the Roman Empire. Then Germanic Goths migrated there for a while. There was also a period where the Byzantine Empire, which survived the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, took over. It then experienced trading influence from Italy, chiefly from the trading cities of Venice and Genova, and then came the Mongol influence. So at the start of the 15th century, the Golden Horde, which was the successor state of the Mongol Empire, had been thrown off, and Crimea became an independent state. This independent state became known as the Crimean Khanate, established in 1441. Now, the Golden Horde had adopted Islam as the official religion by the 1320s, and by 1475, Crimea came under the increasing influence of the rising Ottoman Empire, and it was during these centuries that the religion of Islam continued to flourish and establish itself among the Crimean Tatars. The Crimean Khanate and the Ottomans enjoyed a fairly stable relationship, but by the 1780s, the Russian Empire was beginning to grow and become increasingly expansionist, and Crimea was formally annexed into the Russian Empire in 1783. With Russia's invasion, the age of colonialism had finally caught up to Crimea. This complex and colourful history has given it a unique nature and result to Crimea, with Byzantine architecture, Eastern European music, Ottoman legends and folklore, and Arabic calligraphy. So, who are the Crimean Tatars themselves? The Crimean Tatars are a Turkic-speaking Sunni Muslim majority people who are sometimes classed as Europe's oldest surviving Muslim community. The Crimean Tatars claim indigenous status, as they have historically been a majority group up until the mid-18th century, where from time to time they ruled the Crimean Peninsula either independently or through various world empires. And as we've just discussed, the relationship the Crimeans have had with external factors has varied across history. So there have been relationships of trade and commerce, of cooperation and intermarriage, of cultural exchange, as well as war. Now, Tatar is an umbrella term used to describe a whole host of Turkic people, mostly nomadic groups coming to Europe from Central Asia during the medieval period. Their ethnic origins, much like many others, are still the subject of debate between historians and ethnographers. The book, The History of the Tatars Since Ancient Times, describes the Tatars as a large nation comprised of various groups which corresponded to the medieval Tatar states of Kazan, Crimea, Astrakhan, and the Great Horde. The Tatar people themselves are comprised of different lineages, primarily from the Kipchaks, a nomadic people who inhabited parts of the Eurasian steppes. However, the broadness of the term and the patterns of migration over time meant that specifics were needed, so that's why we have Crimean Tatars, Astrakhan Tatars, Kazan Tatars, Siberian Tatars, Volga Tatars, and so on. Side note, the name Tatar should not be used interchangeably with the Mongols, and some ethnographers argue that the Crimean Tatars are completely different to other Tatar nations, as I'll explain now. For the Tatars of Eastern Europe, historians have traced their origins back to the Germanic tribes of the Goths, the Turkic Huns, and as far back as the Greeks. So with tentative conclusions, the Crimean Tatars can be described as a mixture of Turkic Kipchak, Indo-European, like the Greeks and Goths, and the Mongol tribes. In her book, Greta Euling presents that the descendants of the Crimean Tatars go back to even pre-Mongol times, chiefly the ancient peoples known as the Tavri and the Kimmerites of the Crimea. And if researching their history has reinforced one thing for me, it's that the boundary between Asia and Europe is completely artificial. Let's skip forward now to the 1900s and look at the Crimeans in 20th century Russia. So it's under the Russian Empire, which was an autocratic monarchy, where the modern policy of expulsion and discrimination against the Crimean Tatars began. In 1783, following Crimea's annexation, the Russian Tsarina Catherine the Great took control of the land and gave it away to nobles, primarily to ruling ethnic Russians. Russian literature had also become entrenched, with running images of the Crimeans as wild barbarians, in line with how they were borderland peoples and of Eastern origin and therefore uncivilized. The Crimeans were also strongly Muslim. In contrast, the Russian Empire's official religion was Eastern Christianity, specifically the Eastern Orthodox Church. So these layers of a distinct ethnicity of language, race and religion, not to mention the Crimean Tatars' complex history with the region, became a clear example of how this polarization between civilization and barbarism was used by the elite ethnic Russians to differentiate between themselves, the people who ought to be dominant, and the other ethnic groups like the Crimean Tatars who ought to be subjugated. From 1894 to 1917, Russia was ruled by the Emperor Nicholas II. Russia was, by all accounts, up to and during World War I, in a state of complete utter chaos. The army was on its knees, there were staggering casualties and a high death toll, food shortages and severe rationing, strikes after strikes from both the workers and the peasants, and state violence. And all of this led to the explosive events of the Russian Revolution in 1917, when the Bolsheviks, a communist party led by the leader Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, seized power and established the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR for short. Now, the Bolsheviks recognised the vast expanse of area under their control. And just for context, when we talk about the Russian Empire, which the Bolsheviks inherited, we're talking over 170 million people, hundreds of ethnicities, several religions, territory which included Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and then to the east, all of the stans, so Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, as well as the Baltic countries of Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia, as well as parts of Poland. So they had a lot of land to cover and a lot of work to do to convince all of these people to stay loyal to them. So the question now is, how did the communists differ from the Russian imperialists? One key running theme in communism, whether it was under Lenin or Stalin, was to continually stress how different and better the ideology of communism was compared to Western models of monarchy, of religious rule, or of capitalism. Under communism, they said, life would be transformed because it would completely restructure and organise how society was made. In particular, the Communist Party was really keen to emphasise how Western colonial powers would subjugate the colonised people and how violence and exploitation was the basis of their rule. So how were the communists going to be different? Well, the Soviet regime did use violence and other techniques of conquest to bring in all of these people into its centralised system. However, the historian Francine Hirsch argues that while the West defined themselves in opposition to its colonised people, so superior versus inferior myth, the Soviet Union defined itself as the sum of its parts and recognised how its interest was linked to the interests of their vast population. So from 1923, they embarked upon this new policy called indigenisation or nativisation. And what this was essentially to promote and foster and encourage the different native languages, dress, schools, literature, cultural festivals, etc., with the aim to purposefully nationalise the territory of the Soviet Union, to bring the clans and the tribes together to form their respective nations, hence the plural of the word republics in the title USSR. So by marking out the land according to different national republics, it would make administering the area easier. Of course, the eventual goal was that it would all mature into socialism. And so the national republics would live harmoniously because they all worked in sync with each other within this larger communist infrastructure of the economy and politics. And Hirsch describes this process, this policy, as state-sponsored evolutionism. After Lenin passed away, Stalin himself reinforced this policy of nativization by stating publicly that the dominance of ethnic Russians would and could lead to tension and destabilize the strength and unity of the Soviet Union as a whole. Then came Stalin's switch-up. Keeping true to the behavior of a maniacal dictator, in the mid-30s, Stalin began a series of wide-scale repressions which led to mass deportation and execution. Terror was inflicted upon large parts of the Soviet population, and the targets were many, either political in nature, personal rivals, so-called internal enemies and traitors, peasants were accused of class disloyalty, and it included an ever-growing mistrust in the ethnic groups who were now ironically being accused of separatism or disloyalty. And in just a few years' time, nationalist policy in the Soviet Union had become a double-edged sword. In the Crimea, in 1938, four leading Crimean Tatar intellectuals, who were thinkers, artists, and lecturers, were brutally executed. Schools were shut down, the language publication businesses were also liquidated. It became a new phase of Soviet repression. And then came World War II. In 1941, Nazi Germany had attacked the Soviet Union and advanced eastwards. The Crimean Peninsula had fallen to Nazi occupation. As well as exploiting the Soviets, the Nazis also tried to bring in groups to work or support them. Now, research has shown that whilst the overwhelming majority of the Crimean Tatars remained loyal to the communists and their male counterparts were away fighting in the Soviet army, there was a small faction which did, quote-unquote, switch sides and demonstrate support to the Nazis. Now, historians argue how deep this support was, as after all, under Nazi occupation, it was a matter of life or death. Regardless of how small the number of Crimean Tatar collaborators had been, what came next was a major case of brutality. Stalin and his regime did not pause to consider who were the actual so-called Nazi collaborators. Instead, in the early hours of May 18, 1944, he ordered the en masse deportation of the Crimeans, men, women, children, and the elderly. Now, I need to be clear that when we talk about en masse deportation, what I mean is the entire population. In a single day, 191,000 Crimean Tatars were dragged from their homes, put on cattle carts, stripped of their possessions, and exiled to Central Asia, punishment for their so-called treason, which would formally last until 1989. This exile lasted for over 45 years and remains one of Europe's major but forgotten cases of ethnic cleansing. So how did the Crimean Tatars respond? Research of the Crimean Tatars from a modern perspective remains relatively new. Greta Yuling's book is the first ethnographic study of the Crimean Tatars, meaning she's interested in learning about the social and cultural elements of a particular group of people. In the study, she conducted several interviews with Crimeans and is interested in thinking about the use of memory, focusing on parent narratives, and the politics of emotion, that is, using emotion to instigate political action. Yuling has conducted around 54 interviews and has analysed their responses, and what I'd like to do is share some of the conclusions from these interviews. On the topic of indigeneity, there's a running theme in the Crimean Tatar narratives that the 1944 deportation was the single most defining and significant event for their community. The narratives continuously refer back to how unjust the deportation was, but the sense of injustice is twofold. The first layer of injustice is particularly aimed at the Soviet Union itself and the regime. There's a feeling of betrayal, that we weren't Nazi sympathisers, that our men had been fighting in the Soviet army against Nazi Germany, and that they were singled out based on the fact that they were borderland people, that they were thought of as being Eastern and therefore uncivilised, or as being Muslim. The second layer of injustice almost transcends the Soviet regime and focuses on being taken and then denied for over 50 years what they believe is their indigenous right to the Crimea. And when talking during these interviews, they demonstrate that their memory of the initial deportation in 1944 is couched in terms of nature and local spheres. So some example quotes are, "I recall saying goodbye to my beautiful village," or, "Our land had turned into a ghost town and our livestock had been orphaned," or, "Our skies, our animals and our trees cried along with us," end quote. There's a running theme of natural imagery, but also a distinct possessiveness of the land itself. And what they're doing is quite interesting because they're essentially naturalizing their relationship with the Crimean Peninsula. And so by doing that, they're elevating, or they're actually transcending, the rigid structures of modern nationalism, because they're stripping it back to the very land itself, so to nature, the trees, soil, the sky, and the personal home and village. And currently, Crimean Tatars reject the being called a minority ethnic group. Instead, they continuously claim indigenous status, and in doing so, they attach themselves historically and naturally to the peninsula. A second element in their narratives is how memory has been passed down from parents to their children in exile. By keeping the memory of May 1944 alive and continuously emphasising the injustice and the right to Crimea, they're using their people, their community, as a memory bank. And as Greta Yuling points out, memory and emotion serve as a way to not just lose the link to the past, but to also ensure their future is secure. Without the Crimea, the exile continues. With the Crimea, they're home again. And in the interviews with the second and third generation Crimean Tatars, there's also a moral imperative lingering in their speech, with this idea to restore dignity and to honour those who were killed or who had died in exile. As one of them puts it, quote, "The majority of us died in exile without ever setting eyes on the homeland again. Thank God some of us are still here to return to our ancestors' land." In reading these accounts, it's made me reflect on similar issues which face exiled or migrant communities, and I'm talking specifically about cases where they were forced into exile for whatever reason, or living in that country of birth became unbearable or impossible. The impact of that rupture and anger is passed down onto their children, the children of immigrants. And especially where feelings of oppression or injustice are strong, the narrative is also stronger. And in many cases, like the Crimean Tatars, the future generations are expected to carry the mantle in one way or another. In this case, the mantle is of a trauma of being deported unfairly. And so generational trauma has all manner of effect on second and third generations who are growing up in a region where their parents are telling them, "No, you're not from here, we're from elsewhere." And finally, passing down memory is not only an interfamily practice, but it also serves as a political function, and that is to stand against or contrast what the official government narrative is saying. Memory unifies people and it gives them precedence in their efforts. In this case, the Crimean Tatars continue to fight to have their stolen land returned to them, to have their human rights restored and be protected by the law. So, to conclude, the case of the Crimean Tatars reveals how the big story of history can often overshadow, or even erase, micro or smaller histories. In the big story of the Soviet Union, Western historiography has, for the most part, at least until recently, ignored or not given any thought to Eastern Europe and Central Asia. In doing so, we miss out on learning about the complexities of what goes on in communities who don't get a whole lot of screen time. The repressive history Russia has had against this group continues into the present. So, for example, if you take a listen to interviews of ethnic Russians about the Crimean Tatars, many will argue that they were traitors in World War II, which is in line with what the government officially said. And since 2014, Crimean Tatars have been documenting their experience under Putin's government, citing that they had been silenced, policed, labelled as terrorists, and had their prominent leaders forced into exile. At the heart of this book, Greta Yuling presents a group of people who have fallen back on memory and history to form their identity, and who by all accounts believe in an organic connection with territory. Currently, world history has brought us to be divided into artificial nation-states that mostly came about as a result of a number of vested interests. So the concept of feeling connected to a specific territory widens our understanding of how different modern groups think and behave. Lastly, I wouldn't be talking about this book if I didn't think that it was any good. So if anything I've talked about today has sparked your interest, then I would recommend that you do read the book for yourself. It can be a little heavy on theory in parts, but the way Yuling has analysed the history behind this group is both moving and thought-provoking. Thank you for listening to episode 2 of the Voicemails from History podcast.